Right, good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for coming. My name's Ian Lodon, Professor of Criminology at the University of Oxford, so this is an away game for me. And my pleasant task tonight is basically to chair the event and the discussion. This is, as you will see from the information behind you, a public seminar on new media, old media, strategies for penal reform groups. Really, all I need to do by way of introduction is firstly thank the Department of Social Policy and the Mannheim Centre for Criminology here at LSE for hosting this occasion, and to really just introduce our speakers and say a word about the format. First up will be Dr. Marion Corbran. She will be speaking, in fact, about some research she did as a postdoc in the centre of Oxford. The Palmore and the Howard League funded a series of part-time postdoctoral fellowships in the centre, of which Marianne was the second, and the work she's speaking about tonight was conducted during her time there. So she will speak first, and there'll be a series of responses in turn. To save time, we'll do the truncated biography. If anyone feels offended, you can say more when you get a chance to speak. Danny Shaw, two down from me, the BBC's Home Affairs correspondent. Niall Cooper, who's head of media at Amnesty UK. Alan White, the senior news reporter at BuzzFeed. And Andrew Nielsen, who's director of campaigns for the Howard League for Penal Reform. They'll get 10 minutes each. If I do a reasonable job at keeping them to time, we'll have half an hour Q&A and discussion at the end. The final thing, just a final couple of words. Firstly, this, if it's not the first event, given it's only early January, it must be one of the first events celebrating the Howard League's 150th anniversary. I don't know whether you should celebrate the birthdays of penal reform groups or whether somehow they should aspire to abolish themselves. Anyway, it's still going and the work is still work to be done. The next big event in this context is a large three-day conference which the Howard League is hosting at the Keble College in Oxford in March, to which I believe there's information in the packs and you're all warmly invited to come along. Finally, can I just firstly remind you to turn off your phones. You can keep them on because this being a partly about new media, if anybody wants to tweet the proceedings, they can do so under the hashtag HL in uppercase research. So one word. So I think by way of introduction, that's all I need to say. And Marianne, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you. Can you all hear me okay without the microphone? Yeah, great. When the Howard League asked me to carry out this research, they had two concerns. Now, the first concern they had as a special interest group concerned with penal reform was a lack of public knowledge about crime, justice and punishment. And they were also concerned about how, in the way in which they perceived certain sections of the news media to shape public opinion, and in particular by what they saw as distortion or sensationalisation of narratives. But the second concern they also had, more generally, was that in a changing media newscape, where every mainstream news site has its own online site, and in theory there's more space than ever before, the Howard League said that they were finding it harder than ever to gain coverage. So my brief was twofold. It was firstly to explore strategies for them to gain coverage in mainstream news sites, but also to find ways of improving public knowledge and improving public discussion of penal issues through the media. Now, the research I undertook was covered 18 months between 2012 and 2013. And it was a mixture of participant observation at three national newspapers, where I sat in at editorial meetings, leader-writer meetings, to understand why stories were selected, why stories weren't selected. And I also carried out nearly 40 interviews over that 18-month period with the following. I carried them out with Home Affairs and legal correspondents in broadcast, online and print media. I also talked to press officers and directors of communications of NGOs, and also, because this was specifically about coverage of penal issues, I talked to members of the parole board, I talked to former prison governors, I talked to former prisoners, I also talked to current and former chief inspectors of prisons, and to academics working in this field. Now, in my report, I started off by documenting the reasons why a lot of media professionals thought that groups like the Howard League don't get the coverage they'd like to get. And the first reason most of them came up with was that, first of all, even though a special interest group might think a story is newsworthy, it doesn't mean that the press will necessarily think it's newsworthy. It doesn't necessarily mean that they think it will appeal to their particular demographic. Also talked about the fact that there is a lack of personalisation in press releases, but what the press wanted were human interest stories, case studies, and what they often got were press releases with lists of statistics. And thirdly, what they also suggested was for groups like the Howard League, like the PRT, that what they needed to do was to come up with packages, that to gain coverage, what they needed to do was to direct a journalist towards what the point of the story was, instead of letting them find it out from the press release, to come up with a package with contacts, who they should interview, do the groundwork for the journalist. Now, I then went back to NGOs, including the Howard League and the special interest groups, and I talked about these issues that the media had raised, and they came up with a number of counter-arguments. Firstly, they realised the need for personalisation, but a lot of these groups had talked about when they had supplied the press with case studies, it had had unforeseen consequences for the people featured. So that was one reason for not giving the press case studies. Also, press officers talked about how sometimes when they cooperated with the press, sometimes the press would distort the story they were trying to tell. And in particular, I talked to Nick Hardwick, the current chief inspector of prisons, and he was talking about in the coverage of the riots, what the press seemed to go on over and over again was about overcrowding of prisons. And he said that actually the real issue was not having enough staff, that they always knew that they'd have enough room in the prisons for all the prisoners after the riots. It was just what to do with all the prisoners when there weren't enough staff. So in my report, I came up with strategies for NGOs and special interest groups to gain coverage. And I talked about how to steer a journalist in your press release towards the story you want to tell. I talked about doing what journalists do, cultivating contacts within the Home Office so you can give the press, instead of something they know already, privileged inside information. And I also talked about making stories have an emotional content as well as an informational content. But having said that, while as a former media practitioner and somebody who's also currently working in the media again, I really understood the need to make stories newsworthy, because news, after all, it's a business enterprise. It's geared towards entertainment. It always has been driven by commercialism. What I also thought when I gave in my report to the Howard League was that there was, as a researcher, another question that really troubled me, and something that I wanted to discuss with you tonight. Basically, it was, if in order to gain coverage, NGOs have to make their work newsworthy, then doesn't that arguably impinge on their roles as advocates? Isn't the whole point of having NGOs, of special interest groups, to be passionate, to be disruptive, to provide alternative points of view? So what I felt was that, as a practitioner, I was guiding NGOs and special interest groups to making their copy fit normative news values, but as a researcher, I was wondering how they could fit in an increasingly commercial media landscape. And what I found was also, in the case of organisations such as the Howard League and penal reform groups, the other difficulty they were having was that they were essentially peddling unpopular narratives. As one respondent told me from the tabloid press, basically, these narratives, as he said, all news stories basically are stories. They have heroes, they have villains. And as he said quite simply, stories about prisoners' rights, prison conditions for prisoners, they're always going to be the villains. They're never going to be the heroes. So how do you get those narratives in the popular press? Then coupled with that, as I put in my report, there's the fact that changes in the media landscape were increasingly militating against smaller, resource-poor organisations. But basically, although the advent of the internet, of social media, might mean more space, what was actually happening in reality, particularly over the last 3 to 5 years, was that staff cuts right across the industry, due to falls in advertising revenue, falls in readership, etc., meant that although there was more space online, there were actually less staff right across the board to fill this space. So what smaller organisations were saying was that basically, in order to have an online presence, they needed to blog, they needed to tweet, they didn't have the time, they didn't have the resources to do that. And also, what else was happening was that in a landscape where journalists have more space to fill, less time, what they were invariably doing was contacting tried and trusted sources, the resource-rich organisations. So instead of more space, meaning a diversity of voices, of values, of opinions, it was basically the same old voices in new news formats. So what I felt as a researcher was that I was essentially giving organisations like the Howard League and other penal reform groups information in the terms of really a patch-up job, telling them to essentially conform to normative news values, which in some way arguably has to impinge on their role as advocates. But having said that, now I gave in my report to the Howard League in January 2014, and I think 2 years on, the landscape is a lot more hopeful. And I say this for two reasons. Now, the first I put out there quite hesitantly, or should I say tentatively, but I think the first big change from when I wrote the report is that we have a Justice Secretary, for the first time in years, who talks about a prison system that fails to rehabilitate and reform. That the best criminal justice policies are good welfare, social work, and child protection. In other words, for the first time, the language of policymakers is no longer at odds with the language of NGOs and special interest groups. And as Martin Kettle said in an article in The Guardian in 2015, what we're actually watching is a British version of something that's happening in other jurisdictions as well. As he put it, the penny is dropping across the Western world. And beyond that, the prison doesn't always work, that it penalises the poor, the uneducated and marginalised afresh. Narratives that the Howard League and other penal reform groups have been trying to get across in the press for a long time. And secondly, what we've also seen is a reconfiguration of the traditional newsmaking relationship between source and journalist. Now that was present when I was, obviously, when I was carrying out my research in 2012-2013. And the new relationship between journalists and audiences has already been very well documented. And it's really obvious everywhere that every news site has its online website where audiences, viewers, readers are encouraged to interact, to comment on news stories. And working in media as I am at the moment, every programme that's commissioned, you're asked for an interactive element. How can you involve an audience? How is it a two-way process? So we've already seen the changes in the relationship between source, journalist, the traditional news-making relationship, to open up to include audience. Journalists are using Twitter to reach out to audiences, to viewers, to ask for help with stories, to help with investigative stories. But what we're now seeing more and more is sources doing that, sources communicating directly with audiences. And with new audiences, more directly, and I think more effectively than ever before, and in ways that they couldn't have done through old media. So to finish, two examples of this. One example I came across was that of the head of press of a very large international NGO who talked about writing an article on internet repression. And what he said he found was that his work got picked up by a number of bloggers. So what he then did was to actually enlist those bloggers as what he called rather grandly a task e-action force. And what he asked them to do was to actually feature the work of the organisation. So as he said, what he was doing was trading control, if you like, of copy. But what he was also doing was by using these alternative forms of media communication. He was able to put his news out in a way that was not necessarily conforming to normative mainstream news values, but was actually able to promote alternative values, alternative discourses. And also, finally, the potential of the internet for political mobilisation is being increasingly used by NGOs and special interest groups. An example of this has been the use of the internet more recently by the Howard League. And if you remember, way back in 2013, there was a restriction on prisoners being able to receive parcels of personal items. And that Francis Crook, the chief executive of the Howard League, wrote an article about this online and asking the Justice Secretary to review this policy. The Howard League picked up on this, tweeted about this, and also drew attention to followers about to ask them to sign an online petition. But then from there, the whole campaign grew as people started taking pictures of themselves against their bookshelves and actually sending pictures of themselves with their bookshelves with the hashtag shelfies and books for prisoners. And in 2014, this policy was actually reviewed. So this was an example of NGOs, special interest groups, being able to use the internet, new media, in a way they'd never been able to do, and to reach new audiences for political mobilisation. So I think, to sum up, for NGOs and special interest groups concerned particularly with penal politics, which was the aim of my research, I think it is a time of new opportunities. I think, firstly, for the first time in years, the language of policymakers is seeming not to be at odds with the language of special interest groups, and that as a result, perhaps gaining coverage in mainstream news for hitherto unpopular narratives may be easier as a result. I throw this open for discussion. But also the use of the internet to disseminate alternative narratives and to mobilise political opposition seems a new way forward for NGOs and special interest groups to increase public knowledge about their work and to promote alternative discourses. So I think the potential for NGOs to reach new alternative audiences through new media has actually never been greater. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marion. Danny, do you want to go next?
Yeah, thanks very much. Last time I was at a Howard League event was before Christmas, and Michael Gove was speaking, got a reception I can only describe as rapturous. I don't expect that's going to happen today, but Marion has given a fantastic sort of setting out of some of the difficulties and challenges in this area. I wanted to sort of bring it a little bit back to basics and tell you what I look for as a journalist. And to be honest with you, it comes down to this. We are just in the market for stories. That is what it is about. And we don't care where they come from. We just want a good story, whether it's from the Howard League, whether it's from the Ministry of Justice, whether it's from a prisoner who writes a letter to the Times or to Inside Time, more likely. We want a good story. And clearly what defines a good story depends where you come from, depends who you're writing for, whether you're writing for the Daily Mail, whether you're writing for the Guardian, the Independent, or the Ham and High. But that's basically what it comes down to, and I think you've always got to have that at the back of your mind. What is the story? What is the story that you want to be out there? I think the first thing is you've got to try and engage. You've got to try and get our attention. I remember going back some years ago when we got press releases delivered in the post before the days of email, so it is going back a little bit. I got a parcel in the post, unwrapped it, and it was this strange kind of black-looking object, and I realised it was an ankle tag. It was an electronic tag. And, put it round the ankle, had a look at it. Well, this is really interesting. And it was from that that I suddenly looked at the press release and read it because it was from a community justice group, a group that was trying to advocate alternatives to imprisonment and so on. And that grabbed my attention. And, you know, it got me doing a story about alternatives to imprisonment. You know, I'm not saying you can do that every single time, but it's an example of thinking outside the box a little bit. And I think that's what you have to do. What you've got to remember is that as a journalist, I am inundated by emails, by tweets, by phone calls, by news coming at me everywhere, giving me possible stories. Yesterday, for example, I deleted, this is just the emails I deleted, 118 emails, including from groups, Police Spies Out of Our Life, the EEF, the Manufacturers Organisation, the NSPCC, Bright Blue, London First, the Open Society Foundation, CAGE, and also I deleted an email from the Howard League, I'm afraid to say. And that's in addition to the messages I got from political parties, police forces, BBC internal emails, personal emails, the Office for National Statistics, government departments, trade unions, the HMIC, HMIP, academics. I think you get the message. You've really got to sit up and make me notice. That's always been the case, but I think never more so than now, when it is so easy to communicate electronically. This is not the way to start a press release. Following the publication of a new report on transgender equality by the House of Commons Women and Equalities Committee. Sorry, that goes on the delete button. Again, back to basics. Make me sit up and take notice. Don't start your press release, your email with something like that. Because, okay, there might be a few people who will sit up and read it, but I'm telling you that most of the people in my position won't. They won't bother. And also it tells you something about the person who's sending that if they think that they're trying to get my attention by starting an email like that. Who are you targeting? Such an important question. You know, it may be that you want to keep your readers and listeners, viewers of your interest groups or your particular section informed about current events. It may be that you want to appeal to the readers of The Guardian or The Independent, or Radio 4, in which case that's fine. You have to think very carefully. It might be that you want to reach out to groups you don't normally reach to. It could be that you've got a story you think is so good, you want the widest possible coverage. And, you know, for that reason, you want to hit opinion formers, people who it can influence policy in the morning on the Today program, listening on the Today program, whatever. So you have to think very, very carefully. Again, get far too many emails that are just not well directed, that are just sort of saying to me, giving me an idea or a story or keeping me up to date with something that frankly is just irrelevant to what I'm interested in. I know obviously a lot of you haven't got the time to personalize every email and you've got group emails and so on, but you have to think about the cumulative effect of that. If I keep getting emails from the Howard League every week, when you finally send one that tells me about some really important piece of research that you've done, there's a danger that I won't read it. The timing is so important. You know, there is a kind of, there's a time for, in terms of during the day when we're most receptive to stories, sending out emails at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock, when most of the big news bulletins and the agendas have been set, unless you have got something that is so stonkingly amazing, you are not going to get your maximum coverage if you send stuff out at that time. If you embargo things till 1 minute past midnight or 6 a.m. in the morning, there's a good chance that you're going to hit newspapers and you're going to hit some of the early morning coverage because a lot of it is diary-led at that time. So you've got to think really carefully about that. You've got to be cute about the times when it's quite quiet for us, particularly in the holiday periods. I know it doesn't suit you sometimes because it means your spokespeople aren't around. They're sometimes on holiday themselves. The House of Commons isn't sitting or whatever. But actually, some of the quietest periods are during holiday times when you can really maximize the coverage you can get, you know, when we're scrabbling around for news. You've got to be prepared to capitalize on that story that suddenly is leading the bulletins or on the front page of The Sun. You know, Harry Roberts has been released. Kenneth Noy has been refused release. And suddenly there's interest in that story, and you can suddenly, if you're, you know, got interest in the area about imprisonment, penal reform and so on, you can suddenly capitalize on that by getting in there quickly with, you know, with a quote. But that means you've got to be on the ball. The worst thing is to get a press release at, you know, later that day, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, from a story that's been around since the morning. What good is that? And there are still organizations that do that, or even send it out the next day. It's too late. You've got to get in there quickly. You know, there are some, I think the Howard League is good at this, you know, is good at capitalizing quickly on that, because that's your moment when we are casting around for different points of view to comment on that particular item. You've got to be available. You know, I'm sure you're all aware of this. It is no point sending out a press release and not being able to put people up to talk about it, or, you know, giving us, or, you know, I'll give you a call at 10 o'clock in the evening about a big story that's about to break on Newsnight, and we want a guest on, we want someone to talk about it tomorrow morning. You know, the phones answer phone, there's no one answering, we haven't got an out-of-hours number. Those are things you have to make available, you have to be prepared to take that call, because that is your moment to capitalise. You've also got to have a pretty thick skin. You will send out a lot of press releases, you will put a lot of work in to research and to studies and reports that won't get picked up. I'm afraid that's the way of news. If it lands on a day when there's been some awful attack, some terrorist attack, it's not gonna make. If it lands on a day when, you know, the Home Secretary's resigned, it's not going to make. You're just going to have to accept that. You know, there is a certain amount of luck in it, but you've just got to be able to be prepared to weather that storm. You've got to build links with the media in the way that Marion's described. Take us out for cups of coffee. Keep us informed about what's coming up. You know, I like to know things that are coming up weeks in advance. The more notice you can give me when you've done a big piece of research and you can tell me that you've got this coming up, you haven't got the final date yet, but you think it's going to be sometime in March, you know, I'll make a note of that. That's really important. That helps us find case studies. If we need to find case studies, it helps us put a bit of time in the diary. It helps us flag it up with editors and producers and so on. That's really, really important. Issue campaigns, you talked about the books. It's fantastic, the prison books ban. Very well-run campaign, whether you agreed with it or not. I'm not allowed to take a view. The criminal court's charge is another example of you know, something that was a bit left-field. No one really spotted it when it came up. I remember doing, a story on it when it was introduced. Wasn't a lot of interest. No one quite got it. But the Howard League was endlessly tweeting, this person has been fined £200 in the magistrate's court. This person, every day, a drip effect. Then you got, I think, the Independent newspaper to take a bit of interest. They did some articles, slowly built it up, and to a point where really the momentum was unstoppable. So you have to look for those little nuggets of campaigns. And court cases. The Howard League, I know, you know, takes an interest in particular court cases, sponsors some court cases that go through. But those are good stories for us because they are real things that are happening to real people. You get a court case where everything is out in the open that we can cover, and then you get a decision. Clearly, sometimes it goes against you and the coverage will drop off. But sometimes you've raised the issue. And you really need to think about that. Today is an example of the case involving Calais refugees who have won their judicial review case, and four teenage Syrian asylum seekers are going to be allowed to come to Britain to pursue their claims. It was a case that happened on Monday. There was some coverage at the weekend. The only thing I would say is that it would have been really helpful from one of the organisations that was involved in that to flag up that there was likely to be a ruling today, because we only got wind of it quite late on, about 4:30, something like that. And by that point, most of the news bulletins have set their agendas and managed to squeeze something on Radio 4, and I think, you know, there's something on the website. But, you know, flagging up to us, I think there's going to be a ruling in court, it's likely to happen today, you want to keep tabs on that, would have been really helpful. Again, give us notice about things. The other thing, very important, talking about speaker availability, but to have good, articulate people who can argue your cause. Shami Chakrabarty, obviously from Liberty, is, you know, a case in point. You know, there aren't endless numbers of chamois, but she has really raised the profile of that organisation. Again, whether you agree with what they're saying or not, and you need to think when you make appointments or you choose people to articulate your message, not just necessarily the person that's the CEO of the company or the person that fancies themselves as director of campaigns. It actually might be the best person that's good in front of the microphone or comfortable in front of the camera. And finally, quality research. You know, it is also about the quality of what you do and what you put out there. Migration Watch did some high-quality research on issues that people did not want to discuss and that people did not want to talk about some 10 years ago. Whether you agree with the message or not, what they said was interesting. Some of it was very well evidenced. And for that reason, it began to be noticed. And so, you know, I would, you know, argue that it's better to have one or two really high-quality pieces of research a year than bombarding me with emails that are basically repeating the message of what you're trying to say. So we can talk a lot about new media and new tactics, but I would say those are the basics that I think you still have to get right if you want to make an impact.
Thank you very much. Noel Cooper.
I've got film to show, so that I don't know if it's... Just very quickly on Danny. We were watching the Calais thing, and we actually had been kind of told it was going to happen later in the week, so we were completely surprised. Yeah. So my media team were all going, OMG, at about 3 o'clock this afternoon, when they saw it come on Twitter, going, oh, we have to kind of wake our spokesperson up, who was overseas at the time, flying back tonight. So we didn't expect it, so we were kind of expecting it. It didn't quite happen. That's it. So it should. That's okay. You might have to dim the lights. Okay. It should be volume somewhere.
Amnesty International was a means and is a means of mobilizing public opinion on behalf of individual prisoners of conscience.
Bennison rallied the support of public opinion in an action to release thousands of prisoners of conscience.
Well, I think the media is fundamental to everything that Amnesty does.
I think we recognise that the media is a golden ticket for charities because it just helps disseminate the excellent work that they do that much more quickly.
We don't pick up on what you're doing, and what you're doing is to raise fundamental issues of human rights around the world, then they tend not to get the kind of pressure behind them that is required if you're going to achieve change and if you're going to achieve justice.
This is all about reaching out to people. So how do you do that? You do it by telling stories, by telling the stories of somebody held illegally in a detention camp somewhere in Middle East or Africa, wherever it might be. There's no question that media campaigns, when it comes to human rights issues, can be highly effective.
You know, there is nothing like the mass of people raising their voices.
I think it's phenomenally important, and it's normally my first port of call on a breaking news story.
I think that what's happened in the last 10, 15 years represents the democratization of media activity.
No blogging for blogging!
So I think you can honestly say that the media play an absolutely pivotal role.
Okay, so that video really highlights what Amnesty tries to do. Amnesty was formed on the back of a newspaper article. So it's very much at the heart of everything that we try and do. We really look at trying to think how we can really influence change. So what that means for us is that we actually have limited resources. So we need to think how we can influence, where we place ourselves, what we do, and how we use our resources. We can't be scattergun because we simply haven't got the capability to do that. We need to really, really focus on where we place ourselves and what we do. This kind of influences nearly everything we do. So we do have a morning news meeting, very much like the major news outlets. A lot of us are from major news outlets. I used to work for The Independent. Colleagues of mine work at Radio 5. There's some from the BBC, and then you know some other local newspapers as well. So we will have our news meeting. We will go through and we will have looked at the wires. We'll have looked at all the breaking news stories, and we will be coming there at 10:30 in the morning with quotes already written to be as reactive and as fast as possible. The idea of having, we have a clearance process as well, so we need to make sure things are on policy. We try and clear all our quotes by 1 o'clock because we're fully aware of the news meetings. There's normally one at 10:30. There's normally one later on in the afternoon. If we miss the one later on in the afternoon, then we've basically missed the news agenda. So it's absolutely important for us to be really fast and really quick. That's on reactive news. When it comes to Prime Minister questions, for example, today, Prime Minister's questions on a big screen directly above my desk, because I get deafened by it. But all our advocates, policy people will sit around with our media team. We will be watching that, and if there's any breaking news story that we hear on there, we will be straight on today. I think there was one from the SNP leader that was that we were commenting on straight away after that. So we have quotes out immediately. So it's that placing ourselves to be as reactive and as fast as possible is really important. So that's kind of the core bit of Amnesty that you'll see, the kind of reactive stuff that you often see in the media. But it's much bigger than that. And this is where I think we're similar in approach to some what Howard Lee were trying to achieve to do, which is also looking at the longer term campaigns. The ability where we try and actually make change, because that's ultimately what Amnesty is about. Amnesty is about delivering human rights change and getting those things in the media. Where that makes it a bit different is that we will do what we call a theory of change. We will look at every particular issue, every particular campaign. So it will be things such as refugees, which is our issue now, torture, as was highlighted in that video. And we will look and see who's actually the person that can actually change that in a UK context. I'm speaking from the UK office of Amnesty. So we'll be looking at whether it's key MPs, whether there are other key individuals within major businesses that could make change. And we try and make it as though their world, that MP's world, is absolutely surrounded by our issue. Because we haven't got the resources to go for everything. We haven't got the resources to require mass. We want that MP, so Michael Gove would be a classic example, we'll be trying to surround Michael Gove's world with everything connected to our issues that we want to target Michael Gove on. So we'll be looking at his regional papers, we'll be looking at his local radio stations, we'll be looking at the places that he's influenced. So yes, it is the Today programme. It is Newsnight in those examples. Sometimes it is an element of looking for a mass audience and the kind of audience that's a little bit different. So we'll be then looking at some of the magazines like Look magazine or Take a Break, because there'll be an idea that we have at the moment about refugees. The refugees, it's a bit like penal reform in terms of the narrative, and they're the current villains, if you like, of the world. And so we're trying quite a lot of work to try and change the narrative of how people perceive refugees. And to do that, we're working quite hard to place the refugee stories in a positive light in the more difficult to reach areas to try and change the overall narrative. So it means we are having dialogues with the Daily Mail to try and look at how where those elements are and where there is a consistent fear, you know, consistent approach. And it is those human interest stories that really make the breakthrough. It's not the kind of numbers, because you can get lost in numbers sometimes. Numbers are useful sometimes on radio as an occasional throwaway statistic, but a statistic that kind of highlights stuff, but it's the case study. It's the kind of relation that you have. If I was to say to you, 3,000 Syrians are flooding across the Mediterranean and you know 20% are going to drown, that means much less if I say John Smith and his family with his babies were on a boat, they've been pushed into, they've been exploited by, they've had sexual attacks, they're dangerous, they don't know whether they're going to survive on this boat, this rickety boat that has been reused many, many, many times. You're getting a story, you're getting a picture in your head, and you're suddenly imagining what it's like to make that journey, what it's like to be that refugee. And that's where the power of the case study that Danny mentioned is something that we really treasure. So we look for those case studies because they're the ones that bring our stories and our issues to life. One of the hardest jobs Amnesty has is every year we do what is called Right for Rights, where we highlight a very select amount of people, of cases that we want people, all our members, and we have something like 500,000 supporters in the UK, to write to show the solidarity for these people. We have maybe 4,000 or 5,000 cases to look through. We can only highlight a maximum of 20 to 30. So we have our individuals at this team, who I think have the hardest job, look through that and try and think, which of those cases do we highlight? And we have to choose those cases on the basis of what's going to make breakthrough with the media, what's actually going to highlight a wider specific issue, such as torture or the death penalty or issues like that that represent for a whole area. And that's a really difficult job. But as a media team, we sit in there and we have to help make that decision. And it's really tough because, you know, I work for Amnesty because I fundamentally believe in human rights and that we need to tackle the human rights abuses. Every one of those cases has a valid reason to have their case highlighted because those people we highlight, we've got a very good track record of getting those people released or the amount of torture that's happening against them reduced or at least improve their situation. So it's really tough, but we need to pick the ones that Danny's going to pick up or that BBC are going to pick up or that BuzzFeed are going to pick up. And so we have to think about that because it's about putting that person representing that whole big issue. And that's one of the most difficult things we do. In terms of the other thing I wanted to talk about was new approaches as well, because that's part of what we're trying to do. So yes, we do still do the kind of regular meetings with journalists, and you should be meeting coffee with Neil Durkin, as you well know, I flagged it up earlier on, who's one of my colleagues. That's really important, and that remains a really essential part of it. But we need to look up beyond that. So we're looking at treating our members and supporters not as, Suzanne Bloggs, member number blah, 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 who donates £5 a week. We look at her as saying she could be a teacher who has the ability to speak to children, who has the ability to liaise within her local area. Treat her as an individual, somebody who actually can offer more on the human rights debate. So we call it, and it's a bit cheesy, members at the heart, but the idea of taking those messages and making all our supporters as advocates of Amnesty. All of them have that ability to take our message out there into a wider audience. So we're looking more and more to use those. So we've recently recruited what we call regional media support officers. So these are people that have other jobs within the media. Believe there's an ex-BBC journalist in the Northwest who's working with us now, who's putting our stories out into the Northwest and helping train people within that area to speak to the media. That's something quite new that we're trying to do. We also have to, it's a really competitive market. I mean, I'm speaking with the Howard League, and I hope we don't cross each other's media and, like, you know, I hope Danny takes both our stories. But, you know, so looking at that as a competitive market, so we need to think about how we do get those stories and those interesting sound bites, and don't write that press release that's got that really dull bit. Unfortunately, I could have probably brought a few here with me today and gone, Danny, I'm really sorry about this one, and, you know, Alan, you know. I'm sure Neil writes really good stuff. But that sort of element. So we need to be really creative. We need to have really good sound bites. We need to think about stunts. We need to think about how we're different and how we're continually contemporary. So we have a creative element to our work. So we try and have brainstorms. We have what we call a problem-solving team that basically look at it and we'll send, this is a problem. How do we address that? How do we make it a creative solution? So one of the ones classically at the moment is the Human Rights Act. So we're looking at the Human Rights Act and how do we get people engaged with that on its possible abolition. We're looking at refugees. We're thinking about how do we change the narrative on how people perceive refugees. And that's all trying to think of a completely new creative way of making people accept refugees as being welcome in the UK and that they are just like me and you. So that's kind of where we are. It's a really big challenge, but, you know, we're trying to grasp it and trying to be that different and try and get these guys really interested in what we do. Thanks.
Right, our next speaker is Alan White, as a senior news reporter at BuzzFeed.
Hi, everyone. I must apologise for the quality of my PowerPoint presentation, which is a thing I've never done before. So BuzzFeed, this is going to be partly a sort of advert for BuzzFeed because it always kind of surprises me whenever I do these things that actually there's a surprisingly large number of people who don't know what we are and what we do, so they may well know me from such viral hits as the 100 most important cat photos of all time. But we do other stuff, and it's this stuff which I need to talk about. All right. So, yes, there's a list. This is really just repeating what Danny said. We're run now by, so our editor-in-chief is Janine Gibson, who was head of Guardian US, and she has Stuart Miller as her deputy. They're both old-school newspaper journalists running a website. We turn up in the morning and we are asked for stories. And it really isn't, you know, people talk about virality, people talk about exciting ways that we're able to present stuff with our clever content management system and all the rest of it, but actually at the heart of it is I turn up at 9 o'clock in the morning and I need to tell them something that will surprise them, and if I don't, I'm in trouble. Please. So this is the sort of advertising bit. We have a very young readership, and the thing about this readership, let's put all the points up at once. They are using all forms of social media. So if you can get a thing on BuzzFeed, it's probably going to get noticed, and it's probably going to get a little bit more of a run than it would in some other places. The reasons are essentially laid out there. They are sharers. And we're quite conscious, and it's something that we don't really talk about particularly publicly, but we're very conscious that the legacy media kind of has an eye on us a lot of the time. They want to see what we're doing, and if we do a thing, they quite often assume that they should be doing it too, when, you know, half the time they probably shouldn't. We're a good place to come to if you've got offbeat original stories that you might not think would work anywhere else. We're not, also, I think another thing that helps us a bit is we're not politically aligned really anywhere. You know, there's no sort of left-wing, right-wing angle that muddies what we're doing. So if you've got an interesting story with interesting facts, we will take interest. Okay. Yes, I imagine I'll probably get asked stuff about this later, maybe. So virality and making things go viral, which is what we are good at. To give you an indication of the internet. So last year I wrote a story about a dead dog. It was a very sad story. A dog had his last day on earth, and he spent it with his family, and there were some moving pictures of the sort of end of days for Duke, as he was called. That dog was viewed 6 million times because people saw it and were moved by it, and it touched something in them that made them want to share it. In 2015, after having an awareness of the situation for years and after months and months of research with Chris Cook at Newsnight, I finally managed to expose that the government were withholding money from Kids Company to stop Camilla Batman Herridge staying in place as CEO. That story got, I think, 45,000 views. So there's a thing here. And we're totally aware of it, and we're totally happy with it. And we know that serious stories aren't going to pay our bills, but they're hugely, hugely important to us. Don't get that wrong. And there are tricks and things that we know, which we'll maybe end up talking about later, that we can bring into our coverage of the serious stuff to make it more relevant to that young readership. Actually, in the case of Kids Company, that was impossible, but with something like this, which is just one I was looking at things I did in the last couple of months. So this is a British man who's on death row in Ethiopia. I'd done a couple of stories about him. They hadn't really flown. But then I was talking to the campaigners who were helping him, and they said, oh, and you know his 8-year-old daughter wrote to the Queen. And I said, really? Can I see this little girl's letter? And they sent me it, and I used it in a post. And of course, once that went on Facebook, it absolutely exploded. So his cause gets sort of brought to a much wider audience who almost without knowing it, are sharing a story about social justice. Oh, yes. This is just a bit more sort of blatant puffery, really. This morning we brought to attention this story about the man in South, man who was on his honeymoon with his husband in Australia, and the husband died tragically in an accident, and Australia on his death certificate wouldn't recognise that they were married. Within a day, actually, of us covering it, we managed to get the Australian, South Australia Premier to apologise and a shift in policy. And the thing with this story, which actually did get hundreds of thousands of views and did do really well for us, is, again, it was just a good story that no one else had, which I can't repeat enough, is the thing that we're after. There's no sort of viral wizardry going on here. Patrick Strudwick, who's our LGBT editor, just managed to get a good tip off, managed to stand it up, and it blew up the internet, and it then was propagated through all the other news outlets. Okay. Yep. So again, I mean, I know I sort of rather humorously cited the dead dog example, but actually, there is gold in those serious stories. So that went hugely viral for me last week. And it's a thing that the other speakers have touched on. So Saudi Arabia, for a time, you could feel the tides of the internet beginning to kind of take interest in our relationship with Saudi Arabia. Why is it? Is it touching so many people on Twitter? I don't really know, but it is. You can just see how it is. I mean, one thing that we do have that I think a lot of our newspaper competitors don't have is a lot more sort of privileged access to data, mostly on our own site, so we can see how previous things do, but also our sort of skills at tracking what's happening on Facebook and Tumblr and Twitter are probably about as good as it gets. So, you know, the minute, at this moment in time, I am happy to say I'm doing lots of stories about Saudi Arabia because I know that they are going to have impact. So they're not going to get 6 million views, but they're going to have that viral element, they're going to have that shareability to them, which is what we're about. Keep going. So all of these are really just I guess echoing the kinds of things that Danny has spoken about, Marianne a little bit as well. I think human interest story. So, you know, it's a classic deportation case. I think most people in this room who've ever had any experience with journalism know that deportation cases are just a thing that you do, but it's all about picking the right ones. This one's particularly shocking, and it allows you to bring you into a wider discussion about deportation policies. And I'm all about headlines where you don't have to do anything. You literally have to state the facts. That's kind of one of the things that is quite key to a successful BuzzFeed story. We get accused of clickbait quite often, but believe it or not, that's not really a thing that we do. Generally, the idea is to put all the facts there on the headline and in the picture before you've even clicked on the story. Primark Notes Man, just to make the point that we're a global newsroom, we're a really global newsroom. So we have essentially, for older members of the audience may remember MSN Messenger, we have a sort of thing that's a lot like that. We have bureaus around Germany, Brazil, Japan, Australia, Canada, China, Germany, France, Spain, a few other places, and there are reporters in there who are contactable at any second. So if you've got a story which has a sort of international element, then we are in a position to kind of move on it. And so the Primark notes had been going around all the tabloids for a while. I don't know if you remember this story, but people were mysteriously finding notes in their Primark socks saying, help me, I've been forced to make these socks in prison. And what we were able to do was find who the guy was that was sending them, or allegedly sending them. This sort of long read on domestic violence and family courts. I was just picking things at random we'd done this week. So, yep, okay. Yes. Again, going back to this thing about numbers. So this is fascinating. This is a study we did in the States. It's our American desk that did it. Now, it's about the fact that women who have suffered domestic violence keep ending up arrested by local police forces, often because they retaliated. The thing that's interesting about this, and I think this is the thing that makes us unique, this story was, I believe, 5,000 words long and was viewed over a million times, which just doesn't happen anywhere else. It is, I don't think that there's another outlet anywhere that would get that kind of eyeballs on a piece that long and in depth. It's rare, so normally when we do long reads, they, you know, you'd be happy to get a few hundred thousand, but we genuinely brought this issue right to the front of people's imaginations in the States. And so this month, on My Justice Stuff, this one's an interesting one. I couldn't help but notice Marianne talking about goodies and baddies in the justice game. And as I say, we are sort of apolitical, so. But one kind of consistent baddie is outsourcing firms. So, and I think, you know, left and right are pretty generally united on this fact. I've been writing about outsourcing for years, actually, prior to joining BuzzFeed. And there are all sorts of things you can play with if you talk about the private sector and its involvement in justice. And two of the big ones are accountability and transparency. So basically, if you're paying prisoners £10 a week to make very expensive designer clothing, you should probably be quite transparent about how that works. Otherwise, that happens. Yes, a bit more fun with my hero, Michael Gove. it's an interesting time in the justice sector. You're probably going to see more stories like this. And again, another outsourcing firm. So these are all in the last couple of weeks, actually. Again, the point about all of those was just that they are all new lines. They're all fresh stories. So as Danny was saying, and as my editor tells me every morning, with a disappointed look in her eyes, that's what we want. And finally, what else? Anything else? There's some more, yeah. That's it. Thank you very much.
Right, and really finally, it's Andrew Neilson, Director of Campaigns from the Howard League.
I'm going to be quick because I'm at the end. I want to make sure everyone gets a chance to ask questions. And actually, some of what I was going to talk about has been referred to pleasingly by speakers, which is always good. I think the Howard League is like Amnesty about change. And I think for us, as many of you will know because you're here, because you're interested in penal reform, it's system change. It's not necessarily the plight of individuals in the system. We're obviously concerned about that. But what we're trying to actually achieve is systemic change. Something like overcrowding affects potentially everyone in the prison system. And that's quite a difficult thing then to get across, particularly with some of what we've heard tonight about the importance of individual stories. And we've shied away at times from looking at narrow single-issue campaigns, because another thing that we're concerned about is not just ameliorating problems, but actually trying to get radical, sustained solutions. So just improving conditions in a prison isn't necessarily what we want to achieve. If what we really want to achieve is less crime, safer communities, fewer people in prison, which is our tagline. However, recently we have been doing single narrow issue campaigns, so ignore that. And that's mainly because it's been successful for us. I will not spend a lot of time on this, but we have heard about it from Marianne. But the books campaign that we ran in 2014 was a good example of us realizing that sometimes you should do single narrow issue campaigns that aren't actually necessarily going to massively impact on prisoners' lives. Yes, it was bad that Chris Grayling stopped people sending books to prisoners, but you know, at the same time, more people were killing themselves in prison than ever before. There were much more serious issues affecting prisons than necessarily one route for them to get books being restricted. However, what we found is that if you did just do a blog, then you could get little acorns growing into mighty oaks. And we did experience, for us, I think, the first time, what it means to go viral through that blog over the weekend, authors picking up on it, wanting to get involved, again, all through social media. And in the first week of that campaign, we sent a letter to the Telegraph. We started the Shelfie campaign. There was a petition signed by about 30,000 people. That wasn't actually our petition, but we helped support it. And I'll come back to why it wasn't our petition. And we also organised something called The Ballad of Not Reading in Jail after Oscar Wilde's The Ballad of Reading Jail. What we found was that as soon as we realised that we did have something that was genuinely popular online, the important thing was to find lots of things to do every single day that first week to keep it going. And so that was why all these things were arranged. So these were the Shelfies. That was the very first one sent by myself on the 27th of March in a very ill-lit picture. And then there were more, and then there were many, many more. And the media coverage that started to come out, so we had lots of good coverage. We had some unexpected support in places like The Mail and Jan Ward in the column saying it was criminal, which is great because I always thought Jan Ward was criminal, but there you go. We also got international coverage as it went on. And then on the Friday of that first week, we did The Ballad Not Reading in Jail, which was when Carolyn Duffin, it was actually a poet laureate's own idea. She rang us up saying, I'd like to do a poetry reading outside of prison. We went, why don't you do Pentonville? She said, I'm in London on Friday. So we did just that. That was page 3 of The Guardian. And by then, any normal minister would have rolled over, I think. But Chris Grayling is not a normal minister. And one of the reasons Chris Grayling wasn't a normal minister is because he had only very recently, when all this came about, given evidence saying that charities shouldn't be campaigning. So the last thing he could do was U-turn in the face of a charity campaign. Now, that might make you think that we should have despaired, but quite the opposite. It gave us a very obvious line of attack, and we could make it excruciating for him and watch him fail to U-turn. And, you know, eventually he would have to. So we did keep up momentum through various things. We delivered a letter to David Cameron because he wouldn't U-turn, he wouldn't even meet with us. You know, there was just no contact, despite the fact that all these authors were writing to him saying he should meet with us. We did a silent protest, talking about, as Niall did, about creativity. We did a silent protest at a select committee hearing because we knew he was going to be there. He wouldn't meet with us, but we could online the front row where you appear on Parliament TV. You could tip off a few parliamentary journalists, and it's more coverage, and it makes him look ridiculous. And then, by now, we'd actually won in the courts, but we did do a Christmas carol, which was where Santa Claus delivered books that our supporters wanted to be sent to prisoners. We didn't call him Scrooge. That was for you to work out. But it was very successful, and the ultimate testimonial came from Mr. Grayling himself. He said, a great campaign in Conservative Home. Although it was a narrow campaign, it also, though, elucidated a kind of broader point, because it genuinely had prisoners were genuinely actually the subject of something popular for once, and they were genuinely not seen as the villains of this particular piece, because we had a fantastic villain who liked to play the villain already playing that role. And I think that we also found that people who came to us because of this campaign through the books then started getting interested in those other things, like the fact that suicides were on the rise, that there were all these other issues. And we have, you know, retained, fortunately, some of the supporters we gained through that campaign. Just very quickly, because the criminal charge was mentioned, and that was the follow-up, as a journalist, senior journalist, did say to me last year, now you've got the difficult second album. And this was the difficult second album, but it wasn't difficult. Just very quickly, as Danny said, social media was really key to this, and we learnt a lot from the books campaign. And actually, we realised that just simply by highlighting cases every time they came, and they were coming from the local media, these were court reports. All we did was we set up a Google alert, criminal courts charge. Then every single day we'd get sent court cases via Google, reported in the local media, which explained how it was going down. And by August, we were able to compile a dossier and launch the campaign. These are some examples. I don't know if you can read those. I'll read them very quickly. Woman 54, jailed for 6 months in order to pay £230 for stealing 4-pack of lager worth £3.94. Woman who loitered for purpose of prostitution gets engagement and support order, but also a £150 criminal charge. Is this proportionate? Harrogate man ordered to pay £259, including £150 criminal charge, for stealing a copy of FHM. Today we learned of two beggars, one in Derby, one in Coventry, required to pay £660 between them by a system that isn't working. I mean, we did these every single day because we had cases being provided to us through Google every single day. And it was an example of new media making old news. And it was, I mean, lots of news outlets did cover it, but The Independent did particularly focus on it and ran a series of front pages on it. And so it was a nice combination of the old school and the new school, really. You know, the old school, having a story literally on the front page, so that every time you've got what the papers say, you know, it's getting debated. That plus the social media side really worked well, and in, you know, the Ministry of Justice made it very clear to us that they were rowing back and they were looking at it, because of course Michael Gove was by then in post. Just what we learnt, I think, you know, unsurprisingly, NGOs are becoming very keen on. Just to say as well, the criminal charge campaign, it was also highlighting broader issues. You know, as we went along, we realised it wasn't just about the narrow thing of the charge. It was actually about why these people were coming to court in the first place. Or sometimes things like, you know, why was a beggar going to court for begging and then getting a criminal courts charge, which would lead them to do more begging? Why was a woman who was involved in prostitution being given a charge that would, how was she going to pay it? So what we've learned, NGOs very keen on digital comms and petitions and e-activism, and we've heard about that tonight. And of course, it is a very low-cost way, potentially mobilising thousands of supporters. But I think you do need genuine popular public support for your cause if that's going to work. That isn't always the case for us, certainly. I think it's more the case for Amnesty, but we find that actually that is hard. And I think there is evidence as well that there is fatigue from politicians in terms of, and I won't name names, but the emailing your MP about an issue type thing. Their inboxes are fuller than Danny's with those kind of things. And I think they're, you know, I'm not sure it always is as positive as we think. It's sometimes effective, but they don't like you afterwards. And that might have long-term repercussions. That's real populism. The reason why I mentioned petitions is I really don't like petitions. 30,000 signatories for Books for Prisoners was good for us, but not that good. Bring back Jeremy Clarkson got 1 million signatories. And you've got to remember that really real populism doesn't look like the sorts of issues that we deal with, and we shouldn't be fooled into thinking that just because we're on Twitter that makes us populist. So coming back to that point, that although our issues are more about systemic problems, less about individual injustices, and even when we do have case studies, to get willing and able case studies of people who've been in prison, who often don't want to talk about the fact they've been in prison. The last thing, once they're out, they want to go through again is their experience in the criminal justice system. It is hard. We try and do it, and occasionally we've managed to, but it's still a challenge for us. But thinking creatively, criminal charge campaign was full of case studies. They weren't case studies that we were directly in touch with, but we were able to highlight individual stories. And also just this point that social media, I think for the Howard League, is more about new ways of attracting the attention of journalists than actually creating mass public interest or encouraging supporter action. Yes, of course, we want our supporters to do things. We want them to share the content. But actually, in our experience, it's a great way. Twitter in particular is a great way of talking directly to journalists and creating content that they will eventually see. As Danny said, there's a drip effect. If you've got something really compelling and you're just repeating it over and over, people like Danny hopefully will start noticing it. And I think that's really key. And then just to echo what Niall said and Marianne, local media is also key. I've talked about social media here, but you know, the criminal courts charge campaign came from local media and it generated local media. And some of our other campaigns, which I haven't talked about, which have nothing to do with social media, really rely on local media. We've done a lot of work on police arrests of children, and that is a statistics-based campaign. We do FOI requests, find out every year how many child arrests have been, but we can then localise it for every police force area, and local media love that because they see lots of statistics, but not always statistics about their area. I'm going to stop. Thank you.
Right, thank you all so much. There's plenty there for us to discuss, and we've got about 20 minutes, so I'm take questions from the floor. I might take groups of two or three just so that we can get through as many people as possible. If you could wait for the microphone and keep your questions as short as you can.
Thank you. This is not a question, it's an observation. If you flip things over, if you turn things on their head and look at the way in which politicians look at the landscape around them, on the whole, historically, criminal justice politics have been singularly unimportant. There's an assumption somehow that if you create a media landscape, politicians are going to pay regard, but criminal justice problems are eclipsed on the whole by many, many more events. Secondly, what brings politicians' attention to events tends to be the realpolitik of the criminal justice system, so that, for example, what led to the overthrow of an 800-year-old assize system was something that was not reported in the newspapers at all, which was a speech delivered by the Lord Chief Justice to the Lord Mayor's banquet. And it was picked up, I think, in the new Law Journal alone. But that had a galvanic effect, and it led to a Royal Commission, and it led to the abolition of assize. So I think journalism has a place, but it's a very limited place. And looking at the history of criminal justice reform, historically at any rate, what one notices is that the impact made by direct briefings to members of parliament who are interested in particular issues tends to be much greater than, as it were, a blanket coverage in the mass media. Well-fought campaigns by the Howard League, for example, but the National Campaign for the Abolition of the Death Penalty or the Abortion Law Reform Association, they addressed Parliament. They didn't go through, as it were, the filter, the mediation of the media, as it were, very much. They were indifferent to it. They knew that their campaigns were going to be unpopular. They went straight to the politicians. So I think we're looking too much at on some occasions, at the filter, rather than, as it were, the receptors. Thank you.
Hi, it's really a question about how much does the media actually lead societal attitudes, or does society lead the attitudes that the media take? And I'm thinking here a real example of those people in prison, one in six people in prison convicted of a sexual offence. Now, when anybody who has been a sex offender is mentioned in the media, then they are dehumanised. It was only in the 70s or 80s that, of course, it never even made the media. So it's really just about difficult issues, I guess.
Okay, I take both of those things to be about the relative importance of the media in this landscape. So we'll take one more question, then we'll come. Just come to the panel.
Hi there. I wonder if you weren't in your current day jobs and you were advising the Secretary of State, Michael Gove, on how to play the media when you're looking to do something potentially unpopular like close prisons or reduce the number of people going to prison. I wonder how you might brief the minister in that hypothetical situation on dealing with or not dealing with the press.
Right. Anyone want to take any of that up?
I don't think Michael Gove needs my advice. I think he's got a very good team around him. But just coming back to the question about sex offenders, which I think is really interesting. It's a very difficult one to answer, but you can't lump the media in, you know, as though we're all the same, because we're not. We're so different. you know, there are certain newspapers that are completely different in their approach to those stories, to others, and to the way we at BBC try to do those stories. I've done stories about the circle scheme for sex offenders in the community, where members of the community try and support sex offenders. And that was quite difficult to set that up and to get the sex offender to actually talk and be interviewed and so on. And we've done stories, I did a story before Christmas where I went into a prison, Rye Hill, which is a sex offender only prison. And it was a piece about, actually, this is a decent prison trying to do a good job. They are very difficult stories to set up because there is a fear amongst those who have the who control the gates to those institutions that there will be a negative story in the press and it will be just a disaster and it will be, you know, it will put things backwards and also there are some issues around naming the prisoners. Really difficult stories to do, but all I would say is don't think that we're all of the same mind, because we're not. And a lot of us realise that these issues are complex and we have revulsion for some of the offences that have been committed, but we also understand that these are members of the community that are going to be back in the community at some point, and we have to find a way of rehabilitating them. The really nuanced views that sometimes don't come across. I don't know if that helps.
I've got something to add to that. Keep harping on about Kids Company, but one of the things that they were particularly good at, they were very good at PR when they were around, and one of the narratives that they peddled, which was that sort of almost Dickensian sense in which people who were involved in violent street crime were only doing it because of poverty, desperation, and all the rest of it. Now, I actually spent about a year researching gangs for a book, and I know, and I think most sort of criminologists would agree, that actually that kind of violent crime is born of a nexus of different behaviours. So one of the scariest gang members I ever met was actually born into a middle class family, and you know, there were kids he was hanging out with who were far less dangerous but were much more poverty stricken. But the point with the Kids Company narrative is that it sold, and it didn't matter who they were selling to. So it could be the male, the son, who typically just would go hard in on punitive measures for any type of violent crime, as well as the Guardian and the Indian and all the rest of it. So what Danny's saying is right, the media is extremely varied, but they're also extremely capricious and schizophrenic in how they cover individual issues. I mean, think of Alan Kurdi, you know, when that body was found on the beach for the best part of a week, even for the Sun and the Mail, refugees were, you know, terrible, people placed in a terrible situation who we needed to help. Fast forward a couple of months and, you know, they're all racists, rapists and dangerous people again. So, you know, there's the old quote about dogs chasing cars is also true and of note.
I've got something to add. If we go back to your original question, which I think was about does media sort of influence societal attitudes, or is it the other way around? I used to work, in my previous life, I used to work as a scriptwriter. And what we used to do when we were working on the soap opera on Brookside was that every day we were taught to wake up, look at all the newspapers, listen to the news, look at other shows, and sort of tap in, if you like, to the zeitgeist, what was going on. And then when we came to story conference meetings, it was sort of say, okay, there's this in the media, there's that in the media, this is coming up. And in fact, one of the things I remember that the exec producer on Brookside, when I was working at the time, talked about, was how he'd once read that, if any of you in the audience are old enough to remember Dynasty. Basically, yeah, in the 80s, the creators of Dynasty, basically Esther Shapiro and her husband, what they did was they figured out, apparently by listening to the news and all the rest of it, that what was coming up under the new Reagan regime was the sort of interest in business, big business. And so what they thought was that a show that would appeal would be something that was capitalist, that was about glossy oil barons. So if you like, I think, as somebody who worked in the media, has worked as a researcher, gone back, I think the media feeds on itself. So people in the media look at what's being in the media, what's in media culture, and then they feed it back. So it's this cyclical thing. So I think it's actually quite difficult to sort of disentangle what comes first, chicken or egg. I don't know if that answers your question in any way.
Right, let's take another round of questions before someone at the...
I think there's a sense in the charity sector at the moment that it's sort of under attack, partly because of stories like Kids Company and that sort of thing. Do you think there's an argument there, or do charities still have kind of an advantage over government and business in terms of getting positive stories?
Hold the thought. Can we take one more down the front here?
It's a similar thing. My name's Rob. I'm a press officer at the Howard League. But I think in the 150-year history of the charity, I'm the only employee who's also worked for the Daily Mail. And it's on that I talk, really. I was at a recent event celebrating the Human Rights Act 15th anniversary and talking about what might come in terms of new legislation. And every NGO PR who was there put their hand up and said, of course, the Daily Mail never covers our stuff, and so we don't bother anymore. And I thought to myself, when I was at the Mail, none of you ever called me. And I wondered, Marianne, in the course of your research, and also to the journalists present, and for Niall as well, do you find that when PRs call you, they kind of half expect what you're going to say before you've made the call? And is there a sort of sense of defeatism in the industry, which actually does us all a disservice?
Can I answer that one? Yeah. What I found in the course of my research, and also, I think, as somebody who'd worked in the media, gone into academia, that there was a certain mistrust on the part of special interest groups that I interviewed, that a lot of them had said, okay, we actually censor ourselves, we don't touch the Daily Mail because we've had our fingers burned, that they're not going to be interested in this particular story. And I think, as Danny made the point, first of all, you can't write the media off as this monolithic entity. There are different outlets with very different editorial values. But also, you can't actually write an outlet off as having certain editorial values. They change from editor to editor. They change from who's in charge of a newsroom. They change on whether you've got a particularly dynamic journalist. And this was the thing that I talked about in the report, that if anything I wanted to do was to say to people working who are NGOs working special interest groups, do not be afraid of certain sections of the press. They are actually willing to listen to you and to talk to you if you have a good story. But you have to be willing to talk to them. And I think it's really interesting. Again, when I talk to people from the Daily Mail, from Tabloid, they just said, well, actually, they don't bother with us. What do we do? If they don't bother with us, they don't come to us. We have so many things filling our inboxes that we just don't bother. So I think that's a really important point, that people, the NGOs, that special interest groups, should be approaching sections of the press that they don't normally approach.
Do you want to...
I want to answer about all of that. I don't know which one to start with. I'll start with the Mail. We do try and contact the Mail. What we do is we have several meetings where we meet with journalists from all the different outlets. We'll analyse where we think there are connections and where there are breakthroughs. The Mail has agenda on certain issues. we have actually found some surprising things, some obvious things. If we do stories on torture, the Mail loves our stories on torture, loves our stories on the death penalty, so we will speak to the Mail quite a lot on those sort of stories. The surprising thing is they're also very good on Roma, and Roma issues on how people are perceived overseas. So we do quite a lot of work with them on Roma. Trying to remember the couple of journalists we work with. That's a really noticeable, you know, element. And this is also the same paper that was responsible for exposing on the front page Stephen Lawrence 5. So they have a very strong sense of freedom of speech, or freedom of expression. So we work quite a lot with sports people on when they're going overseas and they will have gagging clauses, so they'll have, they'll be told they're not allowed to speak, I think it's 6 months before the Olympic Games. And we did a story on that because we wanted the media to, we wanted sports people to talk out and speak out about issues in China and Azerbaijan and so on. Mail loves those sort of stories. So, you know, we don't ignore the Mail. We think the Mail is very powerful, and also they have a huge online presence. So we see a lot of our stories now made the Mail online all the time. So Mail, not necessarily a bad guy. And it's very difficult because I work in the media section of Amnesty, and I can say that, but everybody else reads the Mail and reads the kind of anti-refugee stuff, and they'll be like, oh. So it's quite difficult for me to get breakthrough and to say we should be working with the Mail more, but I try and do it. The charity sector, are we under attack? Oh, God, yes. Completely and utterly. This is a government that has introduced something called the Lobbying Act, which Amnesty's, I mean, we're not massive, but we're a bit bigger than a lot of the smaller charities. The Lobbying Act means that anything you're going to do that's critical of a government, 7 months out from an election period, you have to register and you have to monitor and you have to record, and you're not allowed to spend over a certain amount, which is brand new. So it means that every time we go into a meeting and discuss the Human Rights Act, we have to monitor how long that meeting took, what the average wage was of the person in the room, how many people were in the room, how long it takes to write a press release, how long it takes to write a statement, how many tweets we write on it. All of that has to be monitored, which we never did before. Now, for Amnesty, we can just about cope with that. Don't like it, obviously. But if you're a smaller charity and you're an issue charity and you're writing a cause against a government line, or it could be actually any political line, because any political party could say you're now trying to skew the election in favour of one thing, you're effectively doing campaigning, then they have to do exactly the same. Now imagine if you're a charity that is three or four strong rather than Amnesty. We have 150 people in our offices in London. That's completely crippling. The amount of paperwork completely stops you. So you're talking a whole load of small charities, and Amnesty has loads of partnerships with small NGOs. But they're all suddenly seeing their work and their ability massively curtailed. It's a huge problem. Also, this is the same government that has recently admitted to spying on Amnesty. GCHQ is spying on Amnesty, and we know that now, which is wonderful. It kind of makes me want to do my job even more. Brilliant, you know, kind of just pick up the phone going, I want to tell, you know, we can kind of critical the government and, you know, expect that to appear somewhere other down the line. and it's a really worrying trend because this is also, we're seeing a global crackdown on the media and on charities and NGOs. It's happening all over the world, and it's really worrying that the government in this country is doing exactly the same, because it just says a massive green light to all the kind of lovely, nasty bad guys out there to say, you know, go ahead, because we're cracking down in the UK. We can't really start being critical voice of Russia, Syria, Zimbabwe, North Korea, South Korea if we don't take human rights, we don't take the voice of the journalists or NGOs seriously in this country. We can't really be that critical voice because we've got no leg to stand on, because we're cracking down on our own NGOs and our own charities here. And I imagine the Howard League will probably find something really similar, because the amount of every time you do something, it's going to be falling into that category. It's a really difficult situation, and we're trying to raise that hugely. So it's difficult for us at Amnesty.
Right, I might just take another couple of questions from the floor and then let another panel to wrap up. I've seen three hands. So
A lot of the examples you've given of wins through the media have been for single issues. I was wondering whether you think the media can be a useful tool for achieving the long-term structural change that Andrew was talking about, sort of the goal of the Howard League.
Two on this row, and then we'll give them the front.
Thank you. I wondered, and I think this comes back to Alan's point about the 6 million views of the dog or the cat, was it? I can't remember. The new media, because I think I've heard mostly this evening things that somebody of enormous age here recognises as forms of media, but the truly new media, the kind of traffic that my grandchildren have, constantly looking at sites and gossiping and picking up stuff, that seems to me new, and I wonder what you think the relationship of all that, because that's what's different nowadays, that everybody can talk to everybody else, they can see stories, they can interact, and understand in whatever way they do something about things. Now, what difference, if anything, does that make to agendas in this field? Is it too far away? Is it not interesting? Has it no impact? Because that does seem to me a very significant difference in how we see the world and how we talk about it nowadays. Or is it just cats and dogs and pretty babies?
Which slightly picks up on the first point is, I guess, which is just one reading of some of what you said, Marianne, so it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts and everyone's thoughts, is this sort of the existing political structures in the background, the existing sort of elitism, that one perhaps sort of negative view of new media is that it either just supports those existing structures, so one way of seeing a lot of what we've said today, maybe with sort of BuzzFeed and some changes accepted, is that it's just new ways of doing the older elitism with perhaps slightly different characters involved. That a lot of this isn't involving the public, it's actually just speaking to a very small number of individuals who have been the case for a long time. Or I guess a variation on that is that, you know, it just obscures a lot of that, that there's a sense that people are being involved, that they're campaigning, that they're getting engaged. But maybe if you've got governments who can just bring in a lobbying bill with not many problems, can do all sorts of other things, with in a sense kind of less scrutiny, despite this kind of increasing apparent public debate. I mean, I know it's a very sort of it might be the last question, it's a very negative sort of view to take, but I think it's a sort of interesting challenge to this kind of view of new media.
Right, final word to everyone, starting at that end of the panel.
Right, I'll take all of these points at once. So, first of all, going back to a question just before those three on the kids' company and charities being under attack point, I really hope not. I really hope that that story didn't have that effect, because anyone who works in the voluntary sector, anyone who followed the story closely, would know that kids' company was very much a special case, very, very unusual compared to pretty much any other charity. That was a point that was brought out repeatedly in Parliament at select committee hearings and got reported. So if the media is attacking charities, that's not great, and B, I truly hope it's not because of that story. It shouldn't be. So on the points that just got raised there, so I think the lady here is quite right about long-term structural change and the new media's impact. It is fair to say that they are more, that the media generally, actually, I think a lot of what I'm about to say now is that everything is new and everything's the same. So on single issue cases, deportation cases, books for prisoners, that sort of thing, I think it clearly can and does have some form of impact. As a journalist, you very rarely know how far you've had an impact. Would the government have reversed its policy anyway? We don't know, more often than not. But over time, you generally get the sense that on these certain specific issues, you know, the media does have an impact. In terms of supporting existing power structures, I think that's quite an interesting point. The media has always been led by its readers. The classic thing is The Sun and which party gets supported at the general election. Did The Sun really win it? No. The Sun followed who were going to win. New media is, in a sense, no different. So if we as BuzzFeed see the Books for Prisoners campaign on Twitter blowing up, it's in our interest to do that. We know it will get us traffic because we can see that there's an inherent human interest there. Which is why, just one other sort of tip for people who are pitching stories and what have you, if you come to me with a story which says, look at this hashtag we've invented and here are some photos we've included, I will be extremely depressed because I know it's not going to happen. This stuff has to happen organically. Now, the Howard League campaigns that Andrew talked about, they're not 100% organic in that they are the work of a charity, but you know, if with Books for Prisoners you tried to do that campaign and no one had really bit, you'd have just given up, but they did. And so it grew and grew, and that makes it a thing of interest to new media. So, yes, we are probably more so because it's happening on individual stories led by the public, whereas previously on old media, there wasn't that depth of insight. So your editor of The Express knows that if he puts Madeleine McCann on the front page, his sales go up. That's about all the insight he has, really. What else goes in the paper, he doesn't really know. you know, as to how happy the readers are, apart from letters, whereas we see figures on every single thing that we do. So we're extremely led by what the public are talking about.
Just to pick up on the charities point, I mean, I think the charity sector is under attack. It has been under attack in the past. It's not new to this government. This government has a particular conception of what charities should be doing, which, when it was a coalition, could have been summed up by the "they should stick to their knitting" remark. And certainly it motivated me personally during the books campaign that, you know, we were a charity that was campaigning against the minister who didn't think charities should campaign, and it probably upped my aggression level during that campaign. I think there is another point, though, to make, which is I think to the degree to which charities are the last institution to have a battering that was coming. We've seen banks, we've seen politicians, we've seen journalists have trust in them as institutions being attacked through expenses or Leveson and hacking or, you know, a financial crash. And there is a little, you know, I think there is a degree to which charities which still retain high public trust, nonetheless, and I won't name names, they're not in here tonight, but there are household names which are under some assault, and some of that's legitimate. And there is some housekeeping to be done out of some of those stories, but it is clearly also amped up by political motivation, which is not so good. And, you know, Alan's story revealed really important things that we needed to know about a charity with a household name. On the single issue systemic change, I mean, that's the big ask. And are we just supporting existing structures? You know, I think with the books campaign, if I'm an optimist, I'd say, as I say, that it changed. You know, you saw prisoners' issues being dealt with in a more positive way, and that could have a broader impact and help to play, for example, maybe in the change of rhetoric that Michael Gove introduced. You know, one of the first things the first thing he did was reverse the ban, make it official. The courts had already challenged it, but he kind of went that bit further. But at the same time, I also know that one of the things that made the Shelfie campaign successful was that we were going straight for middle-class people who just liked the opportunity to show their great reading on their shelves. that was the constituency that was tweeting the Shelfies. It wasn't the Sun readers. Yeah, maybe they just felt good about themselves, and maybe that's actually not lasting change. So, yeah, it depends. But I would be very worried if we were doing these single issue campaigns and there wasn't this other dimension which at least points to broader things. And it's the same with the criminal courts charge. And that's certainly an aspect of that campaign that we'd like to pick up on with Michael Gove and whatever he's going to do in the coming months.
I'll be brief because since you all want to go and have a beer or something. I would just say on whether you can affect long-term change, attitudinal change or real change, I think you can. I think just look at people's attitudes to penal policy, punishment, criminal justice now compared to 20 years ago. I think those attitudes have shifted quite a lot. People's attitudes towards the death penalty, for example, is an indicator of that, and I think people's acceptance that criminals need to be locked up, punished, some of them, but they are going to come out, we need to rehabilitate them. I think the debate really has shifted, certainly since I've been covering this area, whether that's due to the work of Howard League, Prison Reform Trust, and other groups. I think that's contributed. I think there may be other issues that have contributed to it as well, but you definitely can, over a long period of time, have an influence on that. I've got absolutely no doubt about it at all.
Thank you, Danny. I think there is ability to do a long-term change. It takes. We honestly, there's a load of issues that we have that we will plan 8-10 years, an 8-10 year plan. Certainly, arms trade treaty was something that was dreamt up. It took 20 years to get to fruition, and there used to be. Bananas were more regulated than a bullet, and now that's no longer the case, but that took 20 years. So it does take a long time to make change, and we will always plan for that because that's what we believe in Amnesty. On new media and the capacity issue, it's real difficult, new media, because there's so many different outlets we have to try and look at what's going to be the most influential. And it's our hardest, one of the hardest things to do, because there's so many different places to go, and we can only pick what we can pick. So it's all about resources, and as I mentioned earlier on, targeting the right ones. So it's difficult for us, but that's the kind of golden ticket if we can find it. And if you guys know one.
Finally, going back to Francis's and Harry's sort of question, you know, basically, was all this content about cats and dogs any different to what was on old media? Is new media basically the same old news as old media? I think basically, yes, it is. That's really the thing that I found as a researcher who'd been a media practitioner, as I said in my talk. But what I found was I was advising organisations like the Howard League how to gain news coverage. But I was telling them how to do this in order to conform to normative news values. So basically, to get coverage, they have to have personalisation, maybe celebrity endorsement, something catchy that will grab an audience. And in terms of affecting change, I thought of two things, one of which I covered tonight and one of which I covered in my report. Firstly, I talked about, as opposed to when we talk about new media, I think it's important to be specific. I'm not talking about alternative news sites like BuzzFeed. I'm talking about new media as in terms of social media, Twitter, where organisations can communicate directly with new audiences. And I think there is a potential there for NGOs, for special interest groups, to target new audiences. But something else that I'll just give a plug for something that I'm doing at the moment is that, as I say, I used to be a television scriptwriter, and I'm now working with one of the world's biggest companies, Fremantle Media. And we're working right across the board on a series of documentaries and a series of crime dramas. And where we all came from was we sort of grew up on Plays for Today, on those dramas before our time, but we were influenced by them, by the sort of Ken Loach, Tony Garnett, things like Kathy Come Home, dramas about homelessness. And what we thought was that basically the way some of those programs are hugely influential in bringing about social change. So what they've asked me to do is to actually come back as somebody who's been an academic researcher. And instead of just trotting out the same old police dramas, the same old crime dramas, to look at issues that are raised by the Howard League about prisoners' conditions, about stigmatisation of prisoners' families, and to actually bring those to a wider public. So that, in a sense, in terms of potential for change through the media and what you were talking about, you know, does media shape society's attitude and so on, I think there is huge potential out there, and I think people are starting to realise this, and there is both in drama and in news, and I think there are a whole lot of opportunities that are yet untapped to do that.
Thank you. That seems a great place to end. That I think has been a hugely interesting and important discussion. Thank you all for coming and contributing to it. Can you also thank our panel?
Hang on, our 150th anniversary, and I wanted to
thank you all very much.